Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9 p.m. British Summer Time. Today is August 17th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. If we have a review of what's been happening this week, then stock markets have been generally steady. In fact, the S&P and the Dow Jones have been virtually static for the entire week and are finishing out on a positive note. The bond markets have been soft pretty much all week, and US Treasuries, gilts, bunds, JGBs, the Swiss 10-year, the Canadian 10-year, the Australian 10-year, they've all returned to the first area of potential support, which is the region of the upper side of underlying trading ranges. They're a bit oversold in the short term, and there is the capacity that they may bounce from here. The degree to which they bounce will probably have an impact on the ability of stock markets to continue to rally in this environment. In the commodity complex, there's been really quite a lot of action. In the precious metal markets, gold continues to hold above $1,600. In the last 2 days, platinum, which has been ranging in the region of $1,400, has rallied impressively. It's tacked on $75 to the price as a result of the mining dispute between rival trade unions at various platinum mines in South Africa. That's acting as a catalyst for what is already a finely balanced market. In the energy complex, Brent crude rallied pretty much all week. It was down by about $1.40 in here today. It is a bit overbought in the short term, but absolutely nothing has happened to really question the intensity of this advance. It is approaching the psychological $120 level on Brent, and that has been an area of resistance on at least two occasions in the last year. So there is the possibility that it will also run into some karma up here at this level. In the industrial metal complex, the majority appear to have found at least short-term support. They were all a bit firmer into the end of the week. In the grain and bean complex, we see that the majority of these markets have been really quite steady over the last couple of weeks, but it is following really quite an impressive advance already. The fact that they've been steady is out of character with the speed with which they rallied to these levels, and therefore it can be characterized as a loss of momentum. Given the fact that you had a downside key in corn last week, a little bit of follow through, and now you're seeing another little bit of a rally in here, it is becoming a much more uncertain environment. Certainly the drought hasn't broken yet in the US, and there has almost certainly been damage done to the crops, but it remains to be seen just how bad that is. And the corn price, it is coming in, it is looking a little bit more uncertain up here at these levels. From a trader or an investor's perspective, it does represent a rather dangerous environment because of the potential for quite considerable increases in volatility. The other interesting markets in here this week were London sugar, which has become overextended to the downside. So is orange juice. Lumber, on the other hand, has pushed back above the $300 area, and that is a new high for at least the last year. That's at least in part because of the drought in the USA, but potentially also because of new housing starts in the USA, which continue to beat estimates and have been doing so now for the better part of 6 months to a year. In Asia this week, the Chinese market having rallied impressively from late July, pulled back and retested its low, where it steadied at the end of the week. the Japanese yen has weakened from the 78 area. That should act as a tailwind for the Japanese stock market and the Nikkei, and the topics as well as the banking sectors were all firm in here this week. The ASEAN region continues to remain the relative strength leader, but it has moved to a position, at least temporarily, of underperformance compared to Europe, which is bouncing rather emphatically from really very depressed levels. And when we take a step back and we look at the long term and the potential of differing markets, it's perhaps an opportune time to talk about the difference between leadership and outperformance, because we characterize the ASEAN markets as leaders. And when we talk about leadership, it's from a temporal perspective. It's about timing. Those ASEAN markets, particularly Indonesia and Malaysia and the Philippines, they bottomed in 2008. The wider market didn't bottom until the first quarter of 2009. They broke out of their bases when the wider market was simply bottoming. They were among the first markets in the world to take out their 2008 peaks, and they have led global markets into periods of consolidation, and they've tended to lead on the way out. Of the markets that have pushed on to new all-time highs in the last month, more than half of them have been from the ASEAN region. So that is a leadership designation. When they start to look inconsistent, when they experience much bigger pullbacks, and when these impressive advances start to roll over, that will be a significant signal that the bull market that has been in underway for the last 3.5 years will be in its final legs. But when we contrast leadership with relative strength or outperformance, then those leading markets will outperform when they start moving to new highs. But because they are prone to moving into corrective phases considerably ahead of other markets, there will be times when they turn to positions of underperformance relative to other markets. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now, because Europe is coming off of really very depressed levels. And particularly the Spanish and Italian markets and a number of the Eastern European markets are coming from depressed levels. There was an incredible amount of bearishness expressed in the media and among investors about the prospects for these markets. People were pushing money increasingly into the fixed income markets, where we saw short-dated bond yields getting into negative territory for Germany. And people were expressing an incredibly bearish view as to the sustainability of the euro. Well, that was certainly the case in late July, when everybody was expecting a rerun of what happened in 2011, when the majority of European politicians went on holiday. There was no one left at the helm, and it was an opportunity for short sellers to really become active. The ECB on this occasion decided that they were not going to let that happen again. And the way of monitoring the amount of liquidity, or the way that the ECB has been putting money into the market, is through the Eurozone's equivalent of the TED spread. And that's the spread between 3-month Euro LIBOR over 3-month generic government bond yields. And the generic government bond yield generally equates to the German 3-month. And that spread has been contracting steadily for nearly 2 months. It suggests that the ECB is making liquidity available in abundant amounts via the discount window. And that is removing some of the pressure from the banking sectors. It is interesting that even Spanish banks like Banco Santander and BBVA have pushed back above the 200-day moving averages. They've posted failed downside breaks in the last 4 weeks. They've rallied right back up to the upper side of their respective ranges, and they've broken upwards. That's really impressive action. And it's starting to begin to price in the possibility that the Eurozone is not going to disappear overnight. It's also pricing in the possibility that Spain is going to apply for a full-blown bailout, and I suspect that that is an inevitability, and that they will be given the money. We are starting to see signs from Angela Merkel that she is willing now to do what is necessary to ensure the survival of the Eurozone project. And that is going to require more fiscal cohesion, a banking union, and more cooperation on a number of different economic fronts. Those were the missing ingredients when the euro was formed. The euro has certainly been a net positive for Germany in particular, and it would be a massive miscalculation from the perspective of Germany to dispense with the eurozone. And since that is a fact, the likelihood is that the euro is going to be around for a considerable amount of time, and the only question is how many countries are going to use it as their base currency. What does look likely is that the ECB is going to do whatever it can to ensure its own existence, because without the euro, there is no ECB, and if bureaucrats can be relied on anything, or can be relied on to do anything, it is to preserve their own jobs. When we take that into account, then a number of these European markets were deeply oversold, and they are rallying strongly. We're seeing that there are short covering rallies in place, and there is the capacity for these short covering rallies to persist for a while longer. But what we are now starting to also see are some short-term overbought conditions beginning to develop in some of these markets, particularly those that as they approach areas of previous resistance. Some of the ones that are in areas of previous resistance are the Dutch market and the German market, and the Spanish market is back up to the 200-day moving average, the Italian market also. So there is the potential that we start to see a little bit of a consolidation. What will give us considerably more confidence that we've seen a medium-term low for these markets is if we see demand starting to return at progressively higher levels following a pullback, and when we start to see these markets push back above their 200-day moving averages and break onwards and upwards to new recovery highs for some of the better performers. At present, it looks like we are going to see some additional short covering, and that would suggest that these European markets are likely to outperform for a while longer relative to the wider market. But no one is looking at Europe to be the seedbed for major new bull markets. The debt problems that are existing that exist in Europe at present are going to take a significant amount of time to unwind, and whereas we're seeing that there is some incredibly depressed valuations in Europe and that there is significant room for those valuations to correct back up towards the mean, this is not an environment where one would suspect that we're going to see a major, major, multi-year, decade-long bull market evolve from. In that regard, the ASEAN region continues to remain a relative strength leader. It's also why the autonomy sector is so vital for investors that would prefer to be investing in shares that are listed in the USA or the UK or Europe or indeed a number of other developed markets. What we're seeing at present is the greatest urbanization in history. and literally hundreds of millions of people are being lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes. The middle classes can probably be better described as the disposable income classes. That would suggest that per capita consumption of just about everything is likely to continue to increase, and particularly for those items that the majority of us take for granted in our daily lives. There are some interesting statistics that I've read in the last couple of years about India, where when people move from $1 a day to $2 a day, in other words, that their income doubles, what do they spend that extra dollar on? Obviously, they've been surviving on $1 a day in terms of their food intake. They increase their calorie intake, but that still leaves them with considerable amount of disposable income. And what they spend that on generally are hygiene products and cosmetics. So it is little wonder that companies like Colgate-Palmolive, Procter & Gamble, Unilever, Reckitt-Benckiser are doing substantially better than other types of companies when they have this incredible exposure to the developing consuming class right around the world. When we look at what's happened on Wall Street over the last decade, we've characterized it as a generational-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. We're going to graphically represent that in Comment of the Day next week. Both David and I have been looking at charts of P/E ratios yesterday and today. We've been winnowing out the ones that have very large spikes in their data and don't give very good charts. But, for example, Walmart. When one looks at the price chart, it peaked in 1999. It spent much of the next decade in a lengthy ranging phase. Then it started to put in progressions of higher reaction lows in 2011. It broke out of a relatively lengthy range a few months ago and hit new all-time highs in the last few weeks. Now, when one looks at the P/E ratio for Walmart, what one sees is a bubble peak in 1999 and then a 12-year downtrend where prices went pretty much nowhere, but the P/E ratio came from somewhere over 60 to the region of 10 in a process of P/E ratio contraction. And Walmart, of course, is a dividend aristocrat, which means it's been increasing its dividend annually on consecutive years for at least 25 years. And that's just one example of a major globally oriented company that has gone through this decade-long process of valuation contraction and is now starting to attract investor interest. So while a number of these shares have become temporarily overbought in the short term, and they are susceptible to some mean reversion over the next couple of months, provided they continue to find support at progressively higher levels, and particularly if they find that support in the region of the 200-day moving average, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And because they are underpinned by over a decade of ranging, it does suggest that they have significant room for P/E ratio expansion over the next decade. That's as true of Walmart as it is of Heinz, of Kraft, Coca-Cola, Pepsi. And these companies, which we've been writing about for a number of years, are completing decade-long ranges and pushing on to new high ground. For them, a new secular bull market beckons. For the wider market, when one looks at the S&P It currently yields approximately 2.2%. The market has been going sideways for the better part of 12 years. It has not yet broken upwards to new high ground. It's probably going to take a while longer. But we are starting to see that the shares and companies that are leveraged to the theme that is likely to animate investor spirits for the next decade, the fact that you have this commonality between the autonomies and the ASEAN region, does suggest that that market is already in a secular bull market and that it will take time for the wider market to catch up with that. What follows every secular bear market is a secular bull market. The process of valuation contraction that is still evident in the wider market on the S&P 500 hasn't ended yet. Expectations have gone south over particularly the last 3 years. Even though the S&P has more than doubled since its 2008 lows, or sorry, its 2009 lows, nobody wants to believe it. People have been rushing out to buy bonds. No one expects Wall Street to move into a new secular bull market. But when a market's been going sideways for 12 years and a significant number of its larger components are breaking upwards to new high ground, then betting on an indefinite persistence of the ranging phase is not likely to be rewarding beyond the short to medium term. At some stage, the S&P is going to break upwards to new high ground. It is going to sustain that upward break, and then we're going to be in a new secular bull market for equities where a buy and hold strategy will work. What people tend to do is learn from their mistakes, but employ those new lessons at the wrong time. Because what people are now employing with treasuries in particular is a buy and hold strategy. They say that they are never going to sell them, that anyone who bought bonds at any point between 1980 and 2011 and 2012 made money. All you have to do is buy them when they pull back and you'll make money. And at some point, that is going to stop working. And when it does, it's likely to act as a catalyst, which will have a significant impact on investor behavior. And it's hard to argue that bonds at these levels represent value. What we've had is an incredible momentum move. What we've had is incredible intervention by various governments. But it's hard to argue that some of the most indebted nations on earth are in a better position to pay back their debts by taking out more debt. You cannot fix a debt problem with more debt. But that's the internal contradiction of this market, because they would have us believe that you can. And anyone with a shred of common sense would say that it is impossible. So while we do have this momentum move in government bonds, that is probably the bubble that has yet to pop. It's been a 30-year bull market. It continues to trend higher. We're seeing that these bond prices are now back to their first area of potential support. And when one looks at the total return on those bonds, and it is the total return on a fixed income interest investment that is perhaps more important. So it is total return indices that need to be monitored. When those indices start to lose consistency, when we start to see them breaking below the 200-day moving averages and sustaining those moves, then we will have confirmation of a top. And we'll be in a secular bear market for bonds, and then yield is really going to take on a premium, because investors will not only want to lock in a yield, but they'll need to have something that will also have the capital appreciation to make up for the fact that whatever they bought, the yield is going to be higher at some point in the future. So bond prices will come down, and they'll come down fast. Government bond yields will go higher. And the stock market, in that type of inflationary environment, will have a number of outperformers. But the outperformers will certainly be those where we have companies that have the ability to continue to increase their dividends and offer the potential for capital appreciation. And that's exactly what we have in the autonomies and the dividend aristocrats. When we see that these shares have very solid balance sheets and that they are in a position to continue to increase their dividends. And they know, we can see from their actions that companies know that this is true. When you see, for example, a company like Siemens that currently has that's currently paying a dividend of about 4% and is paying 2.36% on 7-year bonds. Well, it can issue more debt at lower rates and buy in its shares. Now, something that we see at the top of absolutely every bull market is that supply increases substantially. Bull markets don't generally tend to end because the demand component just disappears. What is more often the case is that supply increases and overwhelms even the most bullish demand. And what we're seeing in the bond markets at present is, on the one hand, investors rushing out to buy bonds at any price, and just at the top, as at the top of every other bull market, we're seeing those that hold supply attempting to increase that supply at an ever-increasing rate, because you have governments that are massively increasing the supply of bonds, and you have corporations that are attempting to lock in the lowest cost of capital that they've seen in generations. And as investors, what we really need to ask is, does that represent value from our perspective? And I would argue that it doesn't. That this type of activity is symptomatic of the latter stages of a major bull market. It does not tell us yet that that bull market is over. But the signals, the signs are there that we are in the latter stages of a major bull market. And at the end of every bull market, there is a lot of blood and tears shed by those that adopted a buy and hold strategy. When we can identify a momentum move, then we identify the money control tactics that go with that. And that is that a stop becomes by far the most important consideration, rather than looking at every new high as an opportunity to increase one's position. We need to identify what will it look like when it goes wrong and what will need to happen before we liquidate our positions. So those are the questions that someone needs to ask if they have a big position in bonds, rather than how much more money they can put into the asset class to benefit even more from this momentum move. When we see that an asset class is turning to outperformance and it isn't making headlines and no one is really interested in it, then from a contrarian perspective, that really is very encouraging. And that's exactly what we're seeing with high quality equities at present. Whereas we've seen this incredible compression of sovereign yields and corporate bond spreads, we have not seen that same compression in equity yields. And when we look at the valuations, and we see that there is the capacity for PE ratio expansion in some of these very large companies. Well, the corollary is that there is this potential for dividend yield compression. So that is certainly something to bear in mind. When we look at the currency markets, what we have seen over the last decade is that there's been some very persistent trends, and one of those has been for the US dollar, where the dollar has only recently come off of really very depressed levels. The decline of the dollar over the last decade has been very much in line with this process of valuation contraction. And if we do start to see the US moving into more of a position of leadership and outperformance in the stock markets, then there is a likelihood that that can be beneficial for the US dollar. At present, it continues to remain in this lengthy base on the dollar index, which is weighted heavily by the euro. And the euro is susceptible to some additional weakness. There is no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others. And at present, the eurozone and Japan are at the top of that list. And despite the fact that the USA has got some significant decisions to make within the next 12 months about how it's going to balance its books, there are bigger problems elsewhere. So there is the potential for the dollar to remain a relative strength performer, particularly compared to the euro and to the yen over the medium term. The yen in particular is perhaps the most overvalued currency there is at present. There is significant additional potential for it to weaken from here, and the Japanese stock market is at comparatively depressed levels and rallying at the current stage. China in particular is moving through this process of evolution from an overdependence on infrastructure development to one where developing its human capital is going to become much more of a priority. They continue to tighten on the property market. That is weighing on the stock market, but valuations are back to historic lows. P/E ratios are back at areas where powerful rallies have been initiated previously, and the stock market is now yielding more than it has for a considerable number of years. So a catalyst for a move to outperformance in China would be a significant move to remove some of the tightening measures, particularly on the housing market. An additional liberalization of the bond markets and greater autonomy for the banking sector would all help to stoke investor interest. Something that has been running through my head for the last couple of days has been a comparison between China and South Africa. What we've seen on a number of occasions, particularly with South Africa, is investors expressing a great deal of anxiety about potential for the country rather than its stock market. People are very worried about capitalism, about the ability of capital to be directed in the proper manner within the country. They're worried about nationalizations, and they're worried about corruption, perhaps above all else. And yet, the stock market has continued to push on to new high ground, and it's been led higher by the consumer market. Whereas when we look at China, I'm seeing an increasing number of articles being written by foreigners, particularly about how they want to leave the country, they can't take the corruption any longer, that they see that there's the fabric of society is breaking down, and that everyone is worried more about making money than family values. And those are all, those concerns are non-trivial, but it doesn't say a great deal about the ability of the economy to weather its current predicament. And the stock, one thing that we have, that there is a clear difference between a country like China and a country like South Africa, is in the freedom of the judiciary. If one has a decision taken against one in South Africa, then there is a recourse to the courts. You simply don't have that in China, and one relies on the government's largesse to protect one's rights. So there is differences and there are similarities. But in both cases, the fact that people have deep reservations about the government of the country, it doesn't give us a great deal of insight into the health of the actual economy. And that is definitely something to bear in mind when one looks at markets from the very long term. Because China is going through this evolutionary process, and it is building a consumer economy from scratch. And that is going to take time, and it's going to result in quite a bit of upheaval. Eventually, we'll start to see consumer-oriented companies coming through and taking up a greater percentage of the stock market. And when that happens, then we can start to see not only will they be leaders within the market, but that they'll also start to have a corresponding impact on the performance of the market. Because at present, whereas the consumer staples sector is perhaps the best performing sector in China, it has a negligible market cap relative to the industrials, banks, and materials companies. And that's something that is reflective of the evolution in that market. Governance is everything, and we need to see that the standards of economic governance continue to improve. So it's important to have the reservations and to identify what the problems are, but it's also important to identify when some of these problems start to improve, because if we're seeing the standards of governance improve, then it's that economic governance which is by far the most important. And if that starts to improve, then we do start to see a move to of improvement in various markets. When one looks at the commodity markets, they were by far the first markets to move from the emergence of China as an economic superpower. This evolution that we're seeing from an infrastructure build to a focus more on human capital is having an impact on the commodity markets, particularly the industrial metals, iron ore and coal. But that is likely to remain a short to medium term soft patch for the commodity complex. Because whereas China has already built a lot of its infrastructure, countries like India, and particularly the ASEAN region, have got significant infrastructure projects in the pipeline. And that could act as an additional demand driver for some of these commodities. We remain in this process of urbanization. And the global economy has gone from mostly rural to mostly urban in the last few years. And that process isn't about to reverse. In fact, it's going to intensify. That's likely to remain a significant theme for the better part of a decade and potentially even longer. Because we're living today in perhaps the greatest age of humanity there is ever likely to be. At some point in the next 30 years, the global population is going to peak, After that, it will probably go into decline. We're in this sweet spot in terms of population growth, where people are both living longer and an increasing number of countries have increasing populations. At some point in the next 20 to 30 years, the population growth is going to turn, because the point where the fat point in the data set is going to get passed, and the data is going to flatten out in terms of life expectancy, and then subsequent to that, the number of new births will probably peak. So we're currently in an era where there is likely to be more humans alive than there has ever been before and is ever likely to be again. And that means that the companies that benefit from increasing demand for basic foodstuffs, basic commodities, and basic goods and services are likely to continue to prosper in that environment, regardless of other factors. When one looks at what markets are doing right now, we remain in this environment where monetary policy remains extraordinarily accommodative. And that would suggest that this schizophrenic environment we've been in for the last 3 years, where we see that markets rush ahead, then whatever stimulus was available runs out and they contract violently, more stimulus is pumped in and they expand violently, and vice versa. And we're currently in this environment where we've gone through a very anxious few months. We're on the cusp of additional liquidity injection, and markets could potentially rally for longer than one might expect. This isn't the time to become increasingly bearish. We're 1 month into what has already been an impressive rally. If we continue to see that liquidity is provided into these markets, then capital will always find the most fertile seedbed. And the fact that we're seeing these autonomies and the ASEAN region and increasingly the precious metals starting to move to positions of outperformance, that's all really quite positive. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish all the best to all of you.